Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The case of San Antonio nurse Janine Jones, convicted in 1984 of murdering children in her care, and now suspected of having killed as many as 16 infants, made national headlines. A horrifying true-life medical thriller, this report by an editor of Texas Monthly is written in an understated style that adds to its impact. Despite her dismissal from a hospital post, weird medical obsessions, a history of lying and major on-the-job errors, Jones breezed from one nursing job to the next. The case has intriguing elements: a young, ambitious prosecuting DA, a naive, supportive close associate of the accused serial killer, a public hospital administration that suspected criminal wrongdoing but failed to notify the police and was later accused of cover-up. Elkind, who spares no one, notes with dismay that Jones could be eligible for parole as early as next year. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Death Shift, with my special guest journalist and author, Peter Elkind. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Peter Elkind.
Very good to be with you, Dan.
Thank you very much. Let's get right into this incredible, incredible tale. I think some people know the bigger story, I would say, but not any of the incredible details that you have had incredible access to and bring the reader this, which is now a true crime classic. So the question I want to ask you is, when did this first come out, Peter, and tell us a little bit about the Diversion reissue. Tell us a little bit about Death Shift and what's happening with this classic true crime book now.
Sure, sure. Well, this is going back a few years when I was not even a magazine writer. I was thinking about going to law school. I took a freelance assignment for Texas Monthly Magazine about a case that had broken on the wires, making front page news across the country in the New York Times and elsewhere, about a nurse who was suspected of killing kids under her care. This was in 1983, and she was suspected but not indicted or prosecuted at that stage. And I wrote a long magazine article for Texas Monthly and got offered a job and went to work as a journalist and never went to law school. And I now work at Fortune Magazine. I'm going on to do other stuff. But I went back as the case proceeded, as she was indicted, convicted, covered her trials, and wrote this book. It was published in 1988-89 in first hardcover and then paperback. And it was in print for a number of years and then finally out of print. We've just recently republished it with Diversion Books as an ebook.
Fantastic. Now, before we introduce the characters in this incredible tragedy, let's talk about important places, the location. So as you talk about in your book, this is the ninth largest city in the U.S., San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And one of the poorest cities, as you say, and home to some famous stuff like the Alamo, which is
incredible.
So tell us a little bit about the rise in population and the importance or the rise in importance of San Antonio, what it ended up being and what it is today. Tell us a little bit about San Antonio.
San Antonio is one of America's oldest cities and a very colorful place, Alamo history being just a piece of it. But for a long time, I had a sort of pretty rough-and-tumble legacy, which I talk about in the book, and as I talk about Janine Jones' father, who was a gambler, owned a wild nightclub, had a really interesting, larger-than-life story himself. I tell the story of the city as well as the story of her family. San Antonio's had a very poor... had a large poor population, largely Hispanic population, which relied extremely heavily on the charity hospital in town, which was first called Bexar County Hospital and then renamed Medical Center Hospital. It was moved from downtown, where most of the impoverished population of the city lived, near there, and then moved to the affluent suburbs to the north of downtown, because the city was eager to see it become a more prestigious institution and attract paying patients. But nonetheless, it remained the hospital of last resort, where poor residents of San Antonio went for their emergency care and for hospitalization.
Now, tell us a little bit about Janine Jones and how she came to be with the Jones family. She was, tell us about the adoption and her life in this family.
Sure. Well, her parents couldn't have kids. Her father was Dick Jones, as I mentioned, is a sort of larger-than-life, very colorful character in town, ran nightclubs and was a gambler himself once upon a time. And he and his wife Gladys adopted three kids, and there was a tragic history there. Janine's younger brother blew himself up with a homemade pipe bomb. Her other brother died of cancer, and she, you know, this all contributed to her sense of being a victim and also seeking attention throughout her life. But her dad was this very flamboyant man. And sort of in and out of trouble himself over his lifetime, and then passed away, and she was left with her mother, with whom she had a very contentious relationship.
One of the things that I found was very profound and eerily important is that when you say his brother Travis died with the pipe bomb, was her reaction at the gravesite. So tell us a little bit about the reaction at the gravesite, which will be important when we talk about this case as it evolves.
Well, she reacted as she did later as a nurse, with great drama. Burst into tears, and later on with kids who died under her care, she would wail and moan and cradle the bodies of kids she cared for and who she may well have contributed to their deaths in a very dramatic fashion. She made it appear as though she cared about them more than anybody, even their parents.
Now, you talk quite a bit about the character of Janine Jones through all these tragedies that happen, and her father dies at a fairly early age as well, but she had inherited a lot of the characteristics. You talk about some of the things she inherited was refusal to mince words, very much like her father, and affection for the spotlight, and you talk about the gambler's comfort with risk. So tell us a little bit more about the characteristics of Janine, and while you're at it too, you also describe her appearance, which is important, I think, into her self-esteem and basically some of the behavior that she has when she's young. So tell us a little bit about some of the characteristics of her behavior.
Sure. She was a very plain girl. She was unattractive, and she was very conscious of that. And throughout her life, as a child and older, was clamoring for attention and did all sorts of dramatic things to gain attention, including tell elaborate lies about relative who she claimed a relative was a member of a band and a member of the Monkees, as I recall. She told all kinds of tall tales, which people were very persuaded of because she was very convincing, but was sort of desperate to get attention. And she did all sorts of things to put herself in the spotlight. And that was true of her as a child.
Now, you talk about her school and that really basically all the reports were that she wasn't a horrible student, but she was uninspired. But then there was one area where she really excelled, especially. And so tell us a little bit where she did excel and seemed to come into her own, it seems.
You mean in nursing school?
Yes.
Initially she actually got involved in her first contact with hospitals as a beautician, and she worked actually as a hospital beautician, and then went back to become a licensed vocational nurse. Her special skill as an LVN, even though she's less trained than registered nurses, is she was very, very talented at starting IVs, at starting intravenous lines. And particularly when you're a pediatric nurse, starting an IV is a tricky thing because little kids' veins are so tiny, and it takes a lot of skill to start the IV without sticking the kid 3 and 4 and 5 times, which obviously is difficult with a wiggling child and crying child as well, especially a kid who's very sick. So that became, you know, sort of her stock and trade a little bit early on in her nursing career, that she could start an IV and stick an IV in a fly, as one person put it.
Now, for the people that don't know as well, we kind of skipped ahead there, but we do have a lot to cover anyway. But we were talking about the LVN. So for those people that don't know the difference between an RN and an LVN, mm-hmm. and why did Janine seem to gravitate towards this one-year-only course, the LVN? Tell us the circumstances why she wanted to do that.
Sure. Well, she was tight on money, and she wasn't really in a position to go to nursing school to get a registered nursing degree, which takes a good bit longer of schooling. So she basically wanted to get in and get out. And I don't recall the exact length of the time of the training program, but it's much less difficult than time consuming than being a registered nurse. But you also have less training, and it's kind of a bright line in the nursing world between the licensed nurses, the licensed vocational nurses, and the registered nurses. The registered nurses are typically, you know, regarded as a cut above because they've had more training, and they rank higher on the totem pole. And she had a chip on her shoulder for all sorts of reasons, and that was just one of them.
Now, let's go back, too, because it's important what her behavior is in terms of relationships. She's married right after high school, and then we talk about the children, and then we talk about the stormy relationship that she had with her mother, Gladys. But
mm-hmm.
Gladys ends up being the person that basically rears her kids. So let's go back and talk about her personality, and how was she with her own children, basically, and while she's becoming this nurse and seems to have found her little niche with this one-year course, this LVN, before we start talking about her behavior at work, what was it like at home?
Well, she had a very stormy marriage. She married a fellow named Jim Delaney, and her husband at one point went off to become a sailor. He was gone, and she engaged in affairs. She engaged in affairs with friends, actually family friends, her husband's friends. And would boast about her sexual exploits to people she knew and eventually to colleagues at the hospital. So it was a difficult marriage. Her husband didn't earn much of a living. So she was helping bring home the bacon, and they had a very stormy relationship, and it didn't end very well.
Now, Dick Jones had done well for himself at one time, and enough to the point where he had made plans that his offspring, his adopted children, could live with him. So her and her husband lived on the Jones estates, again, he didn't work much. So this helped. And again, what was the role of the mother really early on, and what was the relationship with Janine and her children? How close was she with her daughter and her son? And tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Gladys had her own issues. She had a drinking problem at one point and then stopped drinking. Dick Jones, as I said, had a history of being a gambler, was kind of a famous San Antonio gambler, and then insisted that he hadn't gambled for many years. He was what we'd call an entrepreneur. He had an outdoor billboard company. He had a lot of different businesses. He's kind of a wheeler dealer. And Janine loved to hang out with him. She was really the parent who she attached herself to. He loved his sense of drama, his bluntness, his sort of high profile. He was a very colorful character. And I think she really tried to model herself after him in a lot of ways. Her mother, who was left at home to take care of the kids, she was less close to, and after her father died, she had a very on-again, off-again, stormy relationship with her, even while her mother took care of Janine's two children while Janine was working very, very long hours in the hospital after she became a nurse.
Now, let's talk about her first assignment at the hospital that she first works at, and you can tell us what hospital she works at. And what are these, again, what is her characteristics of her behavior there? She's only an LVN, and there are registered nurses there. So how does she act despite her lack of training?
Yeah. Well, she started out at excuse me, her first job was at Methodist Hospital, a private hospital in San Antonio. And she began on her shift that became her favorite, which was a 3 to 11 shift. And she worked in the cardiac intensive care unit, where she was dealing with a lot of patients with life-threatening problems, adults, but serious medical problems. And she was fired. She was fired after about 8 months on the job. There was a performance review that said, Ms. Jones tends to make judgments that she has neither the experience nor authority to make. So she was dismissed. And she later insisted that it was, and this was sort of a pattern that you'd see, that developed, one, that she would have trouble with her supervisors and in her early jobs got fired, and two, that she would blame it on everyone else. It was never her fault. She said she had a conflict with a doctor. She said it was a lack of feeling on the physician's part toward a patient, and I stood up for the patient, and he didn't like it. They asked me to resign. In fact, the hospital records, personnel records, which I've seen, show that it was complaints by a patient that led to her firing. And this, again, was the pattern that took place time and time again before she got to the county hospital, medical center hospital, where all these terrible incidents occurred, that she would have problems, she would be insubordinate, and she would blame all her difficulties on someone else, saying that she was just sticking up for the doctors, or sticking up for the patients, excuse me, or that she was pointing out that the doctors were incompetent or had made mistakes. She was always right. They were always wrong. There was never any question about it. She also had a very dramatic manner about her. There was another episode that she's written up in the hospital report, which described that, and this is reading from this, said Ms. Jones began crying in front of patient as she was reviewing the previous evening's incident. This is an incident involving a patient. And after Ms. Jones left, patient noticed the nurse, notified the nurse, complaining of chest pain, nervousness, and high blood pressure. The doctor was notified. Drugs had to be ordered. Anyway, they concluded that she was insubordinate, unprofessional, and ushered her out. And again, she blamed it on others.
Now, the most, I guess, horrifying and surprising thing is that you talk about the dramatic nursing shortage, and just because of administration and lots of the, I guess, ego that's evident, but there are other important factors evident here that would make that when she applies for another job, what is the procedure and what in practicality happens in terms of recommendation or not recommendation from a hospital where she has had a problem like she's just had?
Well, she by the time she applied to Medical Center Hospital, which was previously known as Bexar County Hospital when she first applied there, later became known as Medical Center Hospital, she had already been fired from a couple of jobs in the period of less than a year. But nonetheless, they did very little due diligence. She applied to the coronary care unit at the county hospital, and there wasn't an opening. And then they raised the question of whether she'd be interested in working at pediatrics, and she said yeah, and she went to work. And they really didn't check her background at all, and given the nursing shortage, they were eager to hire nurses, even if they'd had some problems elsewhere. But it doesn't look like they really even investigated what had happened at the other places and why she'd been ushered out.
Now, to sort of round out her character, she's divorced when she's 23, but you include an interesting story about when she is pregnant, she claims that it's this person named Keith Martin.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about a couple of these stories where you're demonstrating something very dramatic about her character.
Well, there is an ambiguity about something which typically isn't very ambiguous, which is who is the father of her child. It was a mystery to family, and she made claims to her parents, to her mother rather, that it was this fellow Keith Martin, who was a friend of hers. Well, Keith Martin later acknowledged to me that he was gay, and that he had never been romantically or sexually involved with Jeanine Jones. They were friends, and nonetheless, she identified him as the father in order to provide kind of a respectable cover for what was going on. It appears, it's my understanding, that in fact the father of her child was her former husband, that they'd gotten together and she'd gotten pregnant. But her mother didn't like the ex-husband, so she Jeanine told a different story, told a lie about who the real father was.
Now, in 1978, she's at the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit at Bexar County Hospital. It's you talk about it being a charity hospital.
Yes.
It's near the city's barrio and slum. So tell us a little bit more about what kind of hospital it was and where it really was and the kind of people it really did, in practical terms, serve.
Yeah. It's actually called Bexar County Hospital. It's a tricky pronunciation, but it's San Antonio's charity hospital. It's San Antonio's county hospital, which is where poor patients go for treatment who can't afford private medical care. And the county hospital is a hospital where people go for emergencies typically, and for people who, again, who don't have insurance. So it's the folks that are really don't have a choice about where they go for their medical treatment. San Antonio had a big poor population. It was largely Hispanic. It's a very sort of economically diverse city. It's got an affluent group, and it's got a very large impoverished community. And they relied very heavily on medical care for the county hospital. At the same time, the county hospital had ambitions. They wanted to transform its image from the old sort of county hospital image to that of a sleek, modern medical center. And so it sort of launched a PR campaign and renamed itself from Bexar County Hospital to Medical Center Hospital. And it also, and this is along with a move that it made to the affluent part of town, which was unfortunately far from the population that it was really serving. But it was all part of the effort to change the image of the place. And this plays a part as in the whole tale, because they're so desperate to change the image and image of the hospital in the community and avoid any sort of hint of scandal.
Now, before we get into, I just talked about it a little bit, but it's interesting that you have the county hospital's personnel department routinely sent Jeanine's former employers a written form seeking information about her job performance and her suitability for employment. And apparently the Methodist Hospital returned the form. It never did answer any of those questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nothing in those records ever indicated she was fired.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's correct. You're stretching my own memory because you on this, but it's clear that proper attention wasn't paid to the issues that she had at her previous jobs. Again, when she finally got to Bexar County Hospital, which became Medical Center Hospital, it was job number three for her as a nurse in a period of just about 13, 14 months. So that should be a red flag that this is a troublesome, difficult employee who bears extremely close observation. Well, when Jeanine got to Bexar County Hospital, none of that seemed to pay no attention to that. And even though she did all sorts of things that should have gotten her fired there before any suspicion of her actually harming kids, they weren't paying that kind of attention to her. They didn't get rid of her.
Now, she meets a person that's very, very helpful throughout her next bit of nursing career, and that's a head nurse named Pat Belko.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about how she can be sort of abrasive to a lot of people. And you chronicle that in the book, but with other people, she's just seems to be endearing. And also, what are some of the kinds of things that we're talking about infractions before we get to, way beyond infractions, murder, but what are the kind of infractions that Jeanine Jones is known for?
Mm-hmm. Well, first let me tell you about her, you know, kind of her personality and her relationship with Pat Belko. Janine had a real ability. Janine was a very polarizing force. There were some people that found her compelling and magnetic and thought she was a fabulous nurse, and who went for her sales job in terms of you know, how passionately she cared for the kids, who were impressed with her sort of technical skill at starting an IV, who didn't mind that she was, you know, coarse, talked about sex on the job, bad-mouthed doctors, offered opinions about everything. They found that kind of, you know, fascinating, compelling, and went for it. And Pat Belko, the head nurse in the ICU, who's a critical figure, kind of a bureaucratic administrator in the unit, became a Janine Jones fan. Thought she was a really good nurse, and was very, very protective of her and defended her time and time again, even when she was insubordinate or engaged in incidents and was reported for doing all kinds of things that she shouldn't have done. And one of the reasons Belko was protective of her was that Belko had had an incident in her own earlier nursing career when she had been accused of things and felt like she had made a mistake, and she felt like she was wrongly maligned, wrongly blamed for the death of a child. So she would become very protective of her because she identified with her and had this experience herself. So anyway, that's a big factor as things moved forward, that she had hovering over her, protecting her, the head nurse in the unit, who was very dismissive of the growing suspicions about Janine Jones.
Now, there's a myriad of incidents that happen slowly but surely, and you chronicle them in the book. There's a Dr. Debbie Rash. But incidents like she's found Jones with a syringe, and then Janine starts making predictions of imminent death to people, and you cite an example where she tells the parents that the child is dead.
Mm-hmm.
The parents rush to the hospital, and the child's alive. Maybe you can explain a story like that.
Sure. Well, this is a child, involves a child named Chris Ogeda, and he was very sick. And by the way, Janine Jones is working in the pediatric intensive care unit. So this is a closed area that's about the size of a garage, where there's just a handful of kids, 8 or 10 or 12. I'm not sure what the exact census was. It varied from time to time. But these kids are all sick. They're not newborns, but they're kids who have left the hospital after being born and come back, and they've got serious medical problems and require intensive care. So this is the pediatric intensive care unit. And this little boy, Chris Ogeda, who was barely a year old, had been in the hospital a lot after his birth. He had a bad heart defect. And then he came into the hospital with pneumonia and diarrhea, developed hepatitis. He had a bad infection. And the parents, who lived fairly far away, and San Antonio served indigent patients whose families lived from quite a distance. It covered a big territory. The Hogatas, in fact, lived in a town called San Angelo, which was 200 miles away. And they'd taken their son to Bexar County Hospital because it was the best hospital within that, anywhere around, which they could send their kid to, because it was the county hospital. Anyway, so the Hogatas had gone home because they couldn't stay there while their child was in the hospital for a long time. They had to work and earn a living. And one day, Janine Jones calls. Janine Jones, who was Christopher's nurse, and says he's gone. About Christopher, he said he's gone to play with the Angels. And the family, which is, of course, heartbroken, the parents gathered the clothes they wanted to bury their baby in. The mom had crocheted a special blanket. They get in their car. They drive 200 miles to San Antonio. They walk into the ICU to claim their child's body. And they walk into the ICU, and Christopher is alive. He's sitting in the ICU bed. He's hooked up to machines. Everything was just as it had been for months. And after they've been told that he's gone to play with the Angels, as Janine put it. So, you know, they were shocked, and they asked for Janine, and Janine had gone home by then. So this very strange episode took place. And then Janine continues to, time and time again, as the nurses gather for their, you know, nightly meetings between shifts, predicts that Christopher Hogueda is going to die. Says tonight's the night. And then there's another episode when Janine had left Christopher Hogueda's bed rails down, and this baby who's got respirator tubing down his throat, and he's got arm restraints and a heart condition, rolls out of his bed and is hanging by these restraints because she's left the bed rails down. Anyway, it's sort of time and time again, there are these nightmarish episodes. And finally, Chris Hogueda dies of cardiac arrest a week later, once again under Janine Jones's care. Anyway, if that weren't bad enough, Janine Jones then is, mourning his body, mourning his death, wraps the baby in a blanket, and holds the dead child, the corpse, to her chest for an hour, rocking back and forth and wailing. Waiting for the parents to arrive. So that's just one episode of many involving Janine Jones and the care of kids, bizarre and troubling, to say the least. But yet the parents thought Janine Jones was a caring nurse, and in fact invited Janine Jones to attend his funeral.
You also, very profound part of the book is that you say that there are, for the bigger children, they put them, again, they had a name for it, a cold plate, but a metal table. But if the child was small, mm-hmm. they could carry the child right down to the morgue. Now, there was mm-hmm. a lot of people that could do this, but tell us about Janine's obsession with doing this and the scene that you set in the book of her walking to the morgue with a child.
Yeah. Well, the typical procedure for doing this after a child died was to wheel the child down to the morgue in a stretcher. But that wasn't what Janine Jones wanted to do. Instead, she typically wanted to show her compassion and anguish over the child's death, even though she was the one treating the child and, in hindsight, played a part in some of these deaths, in a frightening number of deaths. And she would take the baby's body and personally carry it down to the morgue. And there was one point, one episode where a family wanted to cradle the baby after the child had died and say goodbye. And she insisted the child had to go down to the morgue immediately. And she basically grabbed the child's body and ran down the hospital corridor with the baby, with the family in pursuit, and took the baby down to the morgue in this incredibly bizarre scene.
Now, she lived with her mother, even though, again, there was a stormy relationship, and then there was times when she did have custody of her children, but what was, at this very time, what was the relationship with her children, and what was the relationship with her mother? This very caring person that was overly emotional over other people's children, what was the situation with her own children and her own mother?
Well, she was very cold with her mother. She was kind of an ingrate, even though her mother was a full-time babysitter for her kids. Her mother also had a very difficult time with Janine's son, who was rebelling. She favored Janine's daughter, but the boy had a very difficult relationship with his grandmother. Janine also had started to display a pattern where she was bringing her kids in for medical treatment for problems, for an array of problems that, when they were examined, doctors couldn't identify. They didn't see what was wrong with the kids, but she seemed to relish having her children being treated by doctors and in hospital situations.
Didn't she at some point, if not around this time too, be struck apparently with illnesses that were, again, not found by doctors once they examined
yes.
her?
Yes, she did indeed. And And this is part of a phenomenon which you know, the pattern unfolded very dramatically of something called and it applied both to her children, herself, and her patients in different ways, of something called Munchausen syndrome and then Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Munchausen syndrome is a situation where people enjoy being the center of attention in a medical situation and get excitement or attracted to having medical procedures done on them, performed on them, and they appear at the hospital regularly with complaints of serious medical problems that doctors, after examining them, can't identify, can't find. So they come in with complaints, say they have high fever, and the doctors take their temperature and they can't find any fever. And they actually sometimes induce high fever by putting hot compresses on their bodies or cause medical problems, induce medical symptoms artificially so that they'll be admitted to hospitals and have procedures done on them. That's known as Munchausen syndrome. There's also a sort of second aspect of this called Munchausen syndrome by proxy, where you cause medical problems on people that you're caring for, either your own children or in the case of Jeanine Jones, patients, and again, makes you the center of attention. Jeanine Jones herself presented in the hospital repeatedly with all sorts of medical problems that, all sorts of medical complaints that prompted the doctors who worked with her in the hospital to send her for a psychiatric consult. And the psychiatric consult came back and said, I see no evidence of this. I can't come to any other conclusion but that this is psychosomatic, that it's made up.
Now let's get to some of the very, very disturbing behavior, and because it goes on for quite a while, as we alluded to. Rosemary Vega, a couple years old. Placida Ybarra is 4 months. It seems like there's malfunctioning equipment cited, but everybody concludes that there's just too many babies dying. And 9 CPRs, you say, in August 1981, 13 in September, and they're all dying on this 3 to 11 on one nurse's shift. Now, there are even people in this hospital start calling Jeanine's hours on duty the death shift. Isn't that correct?
Yes, no, that's right. I mean, this pattern grew over time in the pediatric intensive care unit, where kids under her care, well, let me back up a step. Kids who were in the hospital would do fine. They came in sick, but they were making progress, and they would improve on the day shift. They'd improve on the overnight shift, but when Jeanine Jones came on duty, they'd suddenly have a reversal. They'd have some medical emergency. And then in too many cases, in a troubling number of cases, they would suffer an arrest, which is this incredibly dramatic event when they require a crash cart and where their hearts stop beating or where they're suffering a life-threatening episode where everyone has to, they call a code and they have to resuscitate them. And this pattern was quite significant. In fact, later on, when this was eventually, belatedly investigated by experts in the Centers for Disease Control who investigate epidemics, they basically explored this as a possible epidemic of what was going on in the ICU. And they found statistically that kids under Jeanine Jones' care were 25 times as likely to suffer an arrest as they were under any other nurse. And under her care, they were 10 times as likely to die on a shift when she worked. So there was a very dramatic pattern, and nobody had the statistics at that point, but there were nurses that noted the pattern, and they actually went to Pat Belko, went to the supervisors of the hospital, and said, too many kids are dying under her. Something is going on. You need to investigate.
Yes, you talk about some brave souls like Susanna Maldonado. She came forward,
yes.
And Belko was a real supporter of Jeanine and said, either, you bring some real dramatic evidence or shut up. But Maldonado was looking. She was poring over all the notes and making a death list. And
yes.
T- tell us what happens with the first. There's a first discovery of a drug overdose or too much drug administered, and that drug is heparin. So tell us what heparin is and why. Tell us about the significance of this discovery and what exactly happened.
Sure. This is a case. There were a number of cases where Janine's patients had problems. They would have emergencies of various kinds. They would stop breathing. But one of the patterns that existed was that they would suddenly have bleeding episodes. They would bleed out of their mouths. They would bleed out of their rectums. They would bleed uncontrollably from all the pores and tissues in their body. There's a medical condition for a really sick, infected kid, which can cause this. And Janine would always blame it on that. But these kids didn't have those. It's called disseminated intravascular coagulation, or DIC. But these kids didn't seem to have that kind of infection, and they didn't show the signs of that really being the case. But they'd have these bleeding episodes. So there's one child named Rolando Santos who was sick and in the ICU. And Rolando Santos had this recurrence whenever Janine Jones was on duty of bleeding problems. And he wouldn't have these problems when other nurses were taking care of him, but he just had them when Janine was on duty. And he had come in with pneumonia to the hospital. He had been improving for a couple of days. This pattern was so troubling that one of the attending doctors on the faculty at the medical school who was treating kids in the ICU began to wonder if somebody was giving Rolando Santos drugs. And time and time again this happened. So finally, the doctor suspected that that the child was getting an overdose of heparin. Heparin is a blood thinner, and it's used medically to deal with blood clots, and you put a little bit of it in an IV to avoid clotting. In this case, there was no reason for Rolando to have any substantial amount of heparin. And ultimately what Dr. Copeland did was, because he suspected that the baby was getting an excessive amount of heparin, he ordered all heparin discontinued from Rolando Santos. In fact, ordered all the heparin removed from the room where the child was being treated. Anyway, despite all this, Rolando Santos starts bleeding again. And this happens when Janine Jones is on duty and she identifies the problem, which gets worse into the evening. And he's having blood leaking out of his body. I described it as being like a water balloon filled with needle holes, that blood is pouring out. And the doctor, who is desperate because this kid's about to die, he fell into a coma, they were about to lose him, his blood pressure was dropping. So the doctor does something really dramatic. He gives Rolando Santos a drug called protamine sulfate, which is a drug used to reverse the effects of heparin. And protamine, this drug, can harm a kid who hadn't gotten heparin, but you know, this doctor was pretty convinced that something was going on, couldn't think of anything else to do, so he gives Rolando Santos a big, big dose of protamine through an IV, and three doses, and finally it stops the bleeding very abruptly, which was proof, absolute proof, that he had gotten an overdose of heparin. At that point, Dr. Copeland, believing that somebody's deliberately giving Rolando Santos heparin, namely Janine Jones, he orders the baby transferred out of the ICU, even though he's really sick still, but just doesn't want him anywhere near Janine Jones, and basically places guards at the baby's room, so nothing further can happen. And lo and behold, 5 days later, this baby is well enough to go home.
Now, we've got to get through to the incredible that conclusion here, that there are enough people that are suspicious here, so an investigation is called, and you have various characters. There's a Patricia Alberti, mm-hmm. really thinks Janine's a killer, but you also have some people
actually confides to her psychiatrist that Janine tells her psychiatrist, I think Janine Jones is killing babies. So
exactly. And you have Jim Robotham and
Robotham. Yeah, Jim Robotham.
Robotham, he's concerned. And you have other people, upper officials. There's Corum, John Guest. There's a nurse, Virginia Musso. So there's a lot of people, and they have this. They get together and they're looking at this. They're investigating this. So in a nutshell, what happens from that investigation?
In a nutshell, not enough. What happens is they have direct accusations from nurses, from doctors, and plenty of anecdotal evidence that Janine Jones is harming kids. In the face of that, but in the absence of absolute proof, they decide to tell no one. They decide that they refuse to call the DA. They refuse to call in investigators, outside investigators. They want to keep it all quiet. Instead, ultimately, after several rounds of discussions, they bring in an outside committee of experts secretly. And they say that this outside committee of medical experts is there to investigate the level of care in the ICU. These are doctors from hospital, very, very esteemed hospital in Philadelphia and Toronto and another hospital, to investigate the matter. And those doctors recognize that something is going on, but again, don't feel like they have absolute proof. So what ends up happening is the hospital administrators, the medical school administrators, decide they've got to get rid of Janine Jones, but they don't want to tell the police, they don't want to tell prosecutors, they don't want a scandal or lawsuits. So what they do is they recommend and decide to upgrade the intensive care unit to all registered nurses and get rid of all the licensed vocational nurses, including Janine Jones, under that pretext. So four or five nurses lose their jobs for no reason. Janine Jones is going to be removed, but all of them are sent off. Janine Jones isn't sent off with warning to anybody who might hire her. All of them are sent off, including Janine Jones, with good recommendations. And explained that they're removed only because the ICU is being upgraded to a higher level of medical care with only registered nurses. So they've kept the whole thing secret, even though the committee itself, as part of a confidential part of its report, identified Janine Jones as the problem.
Now, all of this, too, we mentioned in the opening, there was never any consultation with police at all. There was never even any talk at that point at all of any consultation with police or any law officials whatsoever, was there?
Well, they discussed it. I mean, they overtly discussed the possibility of doing that, and they actually conferred with the hospital's lawyer, and his recommendation was, in the absence of proof, you should say nothing, and they accepted that recommendation. By the way, that's only a lawyer's recommendation. It's not the right thing to do. Obviously, it was very much the wrong thing to do. But that's the course they followed, despite repeated examples of kids being harmed, despite specific accusations. You know, they're not in the business of investigating crime, and yet they refused to turn it over to those who were, to look into whether something terrible was happening. Instead, they get rid of Janine Jones, they wash their hands of her, and they send her off with a good recommendation where she, and the tragedy is she then goes off elsewhere, specifically to the hill country town of Kerrville, in a rural pediatric clinic, and harms more kids and murders another one.
Now tell us about the very strange relationship and very important relationship of Kathleen Holland and Janine Jones. How does Kathleen come to employ Janine and also not have any inkling of her? You would think by this time, well, maybe the first two times it would be glossed over, but you would think by the third time, you already said it, they, in essence, got a recommendation from Belko and Musso, despite everything. But tell us how a little bit about Kathleen Holland and her trusting nature and what it is she sets out to do and what happens when she meets Janine Jones.
Sure. Well, Kathleen Holland is a resident at Bexar County Hospital. She's a doctor in training, and she finishes her residency there. And she is there at the time when there are all these suspicions swirling around Janine. She's aware of them. She's heard them from nurses. She's heard of them from doctors. But she's dismissive of them. She had had kind of a rough childhood herself. She was very defensive about any criticism of herself and just decided that Janine was being unfairly treated. She was one of those in this polarized environment who was on Janine's side and was very protective and defensive of her. But she had heard all of the suspicions about her and rejected them. So then when she, about the time when Janine Jones is being tossed out with a good recommendation from the hospital, Kathy Holland is setting up a private pediatric clinic after finishing her residency in a small town about 60 miles from San Antonio called Kerrville, a rural area which has a mostly elderly population, but a growing population of younger adults with kids. And she sets up a new pediatric practice there. And who does she decide to hire as her nurse, her office nurse, but Janine Jones? She just didn't buy into the accusations surrounding her and brings her aboard as her office nurse.
Now, let's talk about a very important drug, and I'll try to pronounce this properly, succinylcholine. Mm-hmm. And this drug, what is its characteristic? What's its main thing that it's known for?
Sure. And you did a pretty good job. It's called succinylcholine, and it's a drug that that leaves you paralyzed but conscious. And it's used typically in an operating room, a very controlled environment, where you have respirators, you have a large staff ready, everything is very stable and very controlled, and you use it to as your anesthesiologist typically on the scene and administering it, and it's used to paralyze someone, but in order to insert a breathing tube, and it's used routinely for surgery. Because you need to insert a breathing tube for many surgical procedures, but if you think about it, you're paralyzed, but you're completely conscious. You can't breathe for yourself, and so you have to be in a situation where someone or a machine can breathe for you while you're being operated on or whatever is being done. So that's succinylcholine. It's used rarely outside of an operating room setting, but Kathy Holland had it in her office, and it becomes a critical element in what happens next.
Now, Kathy Holland, this is her dream to do this, her private practice, and she is recommended to come to this area, and it was underserviced, we'll say, in terms of pediatricians. So people in the area that had newborns or people with children, period, were pretty excited that this woman was going to be coming in. It seemed to be highly respected. They were excited about the whole thing.
Fresh out of training, cutting edge kind of experience, yeah.
Absolutely. And with her was her right-hand person. It was Janine Jones, this trusted nurse that she figured really had what the kind of characteristics she needed. And it's very tough. She could do that IV thing that seemed to be tough for a lot of people. So, and she had total confidence in this woman. So Chelsea Ann McClellan, her mother is Petty.
Yes.
And her husband is Reed. And they first bring in her to see Kathy Holland. And, of course, Janine Jones is around. So tell us about that very first experience. She just comes in with a bad cold. But tell us what happens on that very first appearance in Kathy Holland's.
Sure. Well, Chelsea McClellan was one of Kathy Holland's first patients. And the McClellans were young parents. They lived about 15 miles outside of town. Very charming, nice people. Sort of country folk. And her dad was a meter reader. Chelsea came in to Dr. Holland's office on the second day she was in private practice, and she basically had sniffles. Janine Jones, she's being examined. Janine Jones takes her in the other room, and the next thing anyone knows is Janine Jones is saying, "Don't go to sleep, baby. Chelsea, wake up." and summons Dr. Holland into the other room in the clinic, and they find Chelsea limp on the examining table, and Janine's putting an oxygen mask over her face, and then she stopped breathing. And she's rushed immediately. They call an ambulance, and she's rushed immediately to the hospital, which is just a few miles away, and she's completely limp. And it's totally unclear what happened. Chelsea starts breathing again on her own after they breathe for her for a while. But as far as the McClellans are concerned, Dr. Holland and Janine Jones have saved Chelsea's life. She had some sort of emergency. They don't understand what happened. But she recovered from it, and the doctor and the nurse are heroes. And that's the first visit by Chelsea McClellan to Dr. Holland's clinic.
Now, we can't go into everything, but there is, again, it looks like there should be some signs. Kathy Holland should be suspicious, but of course, especially at this point, not at all, not whatsoever. And the same family is scheduled to have their son come in, but they say bring Chelsea again and tell us what the premise is to bring her in again, and then what happens at this next time they're in the office.
Sure. This is a couple of weeks later, and Chelsea Petty brings in Chelsea with her son Cameron. Cameron's got the flu. Dr. Holland had asked that they bring in Chelsea as well for a quick checkup after the previous episode that she had. And while she's in there, they decide to go ahead and give her baby shots. Two shots, which Dr. Holland ordered. So Janine is the one who's going to administer them. She prepares the needles, and she injects Chelsea in the thighs with the first shot, and suddenly Chelsea seems to have trouble breathing after the first injection is going in. And Petty McClellan says, stop, do something. She's having another seizure. She's stopping breathing. And Janine says, no, it's okay, and goes ahead and gives her the second shot in the thigh. And by the time she pulls the syringe out, Chelsea stopped breathing completely again. So they call the ambulance. She's limp. She isn't breathing. They rush her to the hospital in Kerrville. She's still in bad shape. They plan to transport her from Kerrville to San Antonio. And everyone sort of piles into a caravan of ambulance cars. On the way for the trip from Kerrville to San Antonio to bring her to the hospital there, and although Chelsea had gotten better for a time, on the way there she stops breathing again, and they pull over to a tiny hospital on the way, try to resuscitate her, and she dies, and Chelsea passed away. Janine Jones is with her the whole time. And she's under Janine's care. And by the way, when she, there are paramedics in there too, and they comment on Janine's strange behavior that, Chelsea arrests, and Janine says, pull this son of a bitch over, and says she's flatlined, and this whole this emergency unfolds, and Chelsea dies at the age of 15 months. The bigger picture, pardon me, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to tell you so the bigger picture is, Chelsea had two episodes in a period of a couple of weeks, but literally what's going on in Dr. Holland's office is in the period of a month, eight kids walk in there with typical office problems. They have colds or sniffles or need shots or, these are not kids going into an emergency room or to a ICU. These are kids going into a doctor's pediatric clinic for routine stuff. And eight kids have nine separate episodes where they stop breathing and are rushed to the hospital in Kerrville, which typically we'll see one or two kid emergencies in a year. That's on a life-threatening basis. And here they're having eight kids who stop breathing in a month from a single doctor's office. It's just mind-boggling. It's only at the very end of this that Dr. Holland becomes concerned and writes and is, after she's confronted with this pattern by the hospital, and the doctors of the hospital, you know, acknowledges and begins to, you know, consider whether something is going on in her office.
The thing is, though, by the time that she finally, you know, enough people tell her that there's something going on and she realizes, she is also a suspect in this because she's been so supportive of Janine Jones all this time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She's offered explanations for everything that's happened. You know, maybe this kid has meningitis. Maybe this kid has pneumonia. Maybe, you know, she's got this mentality that, you know, there's an explanation for every emergency, and is completely dismissive that there's no good explanation for what's going on.
Now, to muddy the waters further, there's a relationship over and beyond the friendly, supportive relationship at work. So tell us a little bit about that and what some people think might be going on there as well.
Sure. Well, Dr. Holland and Janine were very close. Dr. Holland was married at this time to an older man, and he's building a new house for them. About 30 miles, 15 or 20 miles away from Kerrville, and is often spending the night on the construction site. So Dr. Holland is during this period, so she's close to her clinic, has rented or purchased, I've forgotten which, a house in Kerrville where she's allowing Janine to stay. And Janine is staying there, and another nurse who is very close to Janine in San Antonio, part of her circle, named Debbie Sultanfuss, who's working at the hospital, is staying there as well, and Dr. Holland stays there. So in the community of Kerrville, which is a very conservative place, you know, there's all the sort of rumors that there's a sort of den of lesbians there. There's no indication that that's what was going on, but they do have a very close relationship in an assortment of ways. You know, they're spending time at night together, messing around with the Ouija boards and have a very close personal relationship in addition to the professional one, which certainly contributes, you'd think, to Dr. Holland being as blind as she was to what was going on.
Now, there's all kinds of little things that are adding up, too. There's Holland finds a bottle of drugs, and then there's an actual bottle found. But when it's tested, it's 1/6 the strength, so somebody's been replacing it and diluting it and using it. We talked about the
yes.
Ambitious DA. We talk about there's a Dr. Dwayne Packard. He becomes suspicious after Misty Reichenau dies. There's a Dr. Bradley as well, an anesthesiologist. So tell us about some of the people that verge that gather together to become suspicious before we get to the prosecution of Janine
sure.
Jones finally.
Well, Misty didn't die. She stopped breathing. She was one of those kids that stopped
right.
breathing in Kerrville. But this is the period when this is all when it's brought to a stop. What happens is the doctors in the Kerrville hospital are extremely suspicious of what's going on. They're examining the kids the last few kids as they come into the emergency room to wonder, to see what's going on, try to figure out what's happening here with these kids who stop breathing in a pediatric clinic and are being rushed into the emergency room. And at one point, there's an anesthesiologist. They make a point of having this anesthesiologist there to watch what's happening. And the anesthesiologist, who deals with succinylcholine all the time, watches one of the babies, I believe it was Misty, starting to move after being paralyzed previously and not breathing. And she has kind of jerky motions. And it occurs to him, because he's seen this many times, this is what a kid looks like when they're coming out from under the effects of succinylcholine. He's an anesthesiologist. He deals with that drug all the time. And he reports back to the dean of the medical community, an older doctor, I believe he's in his 70s at that point, named Dr. Packard, and they smell a rat, and they get together, and they bring in Dr. Holland, and they say, what do you think is going on? They ask her questions, and they ask her, do you have succinylcholine in your office? And she says, yes, I do. I use it to intubate, if I have an emergency and I need to intubate a kid, to put a breathing tube in, I have it there to make it possible to put the breathing tube down to keep the kid from struggling against the tube. after this all happens, this inquiry, the doctors have decide afterwards to suspend Dr. Holland's privileges. Dr. Holland goes back to her clinic, and she checks her little bottle of succinylcholine. And Janine had previously said it had been lost, but then said she'd found it and ordered more of it. And she inspects the bottle, and the bottle is full, but then she looks at the top of the bottle, and it's got syringe holes in the top. So something strange is going on. It later gets tested. It turns out that it was diluted. It was 5-6 saline solution. So someone, presumably Janine Jones, clearly Janine Jones, had used the drug when it never should have been used, never was authorized to be used or ordered by the doctor. And then to make it appear as though it had never been used, she refilled it with saline solution. So Dr. Holland sees that and freaks out, confronts Janine Jones. All sorts of strange things happen then, including Janine from making a half-hearted suicide attempt, or sort of dramatically announcing that she's leaving what appears to be a suicide note and insisting she's taken an overdose of drugs, although it appears she didn't really take anything that would potentially kill her. And Dr. Holland's privileges are suspended. They're treating no more children. And an investigation has finally begun in Kerrville. And by the way, all this time, the people, the doctors in San Antonio, are learning that there's bad stuff going on involving Kathy Holland and Janine Jones in Kerrville, and still they don't come forward. In fact, they have a committee meeting where they're hearing about this, and they're said that if asked about it, they should all maintain a judicious silence instead of telling the authorities about what's going on.
Yeah,
so at this point,
incredible.
Yeah. So at this point, the investigation finally begins. After all these kids are hurt, after some, kids are killed, all this pain continues for so long.
You know, what's interesting too is just, what's nonfiction just trumps fiction incredibly, is that when you get this person that you've drawn this incredible portrait of, this little Chelsea's death, and then it's deemed in this crazy story as SIDS, so sudden infant death syndrome, very, very interesting that the same reasons why these hospitals are trying to have this judicial silence and their lawyer can't advise them, and it's problematic always, is the prosecution is not that easy as well, because we're talking about circumstantial evidence. And you also talk about that the babysitter comes forward and looks like it's very promising to testify that she actually witnessed Janine Jones administer these lethal doses of drugs, and then they realize that she's a very, very poor witness.
Yes, yeah. This was an incredibly difficult case to prosecute, both in Kerrville and especially in San Antonio, where the kids were very sick to begin with, and where there's so many medical personnel who are having contact with the kids. There's lots of nurses and doctors who are treating the kids in the pediatric ICU. So it's hard to pin it on Janine Jones, to prove that babies were murdered and to prove that she did it. There's very strong circumstantial evidence. There's an incredibly troubling pattern. But it's hard to prove one single murder on her, to prove that she, there's a smoking gun, basically, or a smoking syringe, as they came to call it. In Kerrville, it was difficult, too. Because again, you still have the pattern. I mean, it's an impossible pattern. But you don't have proof that she injected the drug, or at least we didn't think we could get that. So the investigation proceeds on two tracks. When it's finally revealed that the stuff had been going on in San Antonio, there's a big city prosecutor who's conducting a big investigation of what's happening in the county hospital in San Antonio. And there's a rural prosecutor named Ron Sutton who's conducting an investigation of what happened in Kerrville. They're on parallel tracks. They're cooperating with each other, really struggling to come up with a case in San Antonio, despite sifting through an enormous amount of information and convening a grand jury. In Kerrville, they are trying to find out whether there's a way to prove that succinylcholine was used, that Janine Jones had used succinylcholine, and the drug had long been thought to be the perfect murder weapon. for doctors. And
right.
just recently, not long before, they suddenly discovered, the prosecutor, Ron Sutton, discovered that there was a new test that had been pioneered in Sweden to detect the presence of succinylcholine in embalmed body tissue. So once he discovered this, he got a permission and a court order and had Chelsea McCollin's body exhumed and took tissue samples with the help of medical experts in the U.S., had them packed in ice and had them frozen and sent off to for testing by this doctor in Sweden, very acclaimed, esteemed doctor. And lo and behold, it comes back positive for the presence of succinylcholine from the tissue taken from Chelsea McCollin's legs, where she got those baby shots from Jeanine Jones. And that was the critical piece of evidence that kind of nailed the case and led to Jeanine Jones's murder indictment and ultimately her conviction.
Now, how big a story was this in Texas? We can guess, but how big was this story nationally, and how big a story was this internationally, especially at that time? This was quite an unusual story at that time, wasn't it?
It was. It was indeed. I mean, this is on its face as, you know, the most improbable situations. You have a nurse. I mean, it's every parent's worst nightmare. And you have a nurse who's sworn to care for kids who's deliberately harming them, killing them in a medical setting. I mean, it's chilling in every way imaginable. You have a serial killer baby nurse. And it's sensational, of course, too. And so when it first broke that she was even under suspicion of this, that there were there was an investigation of deaths in the county hospital. It was front page news. It was front page news in the New York Times and across the country and overseas some. And it remained a big story through her trial. When I wrote my book, we published editions in England, and I think we had one other international edition. But it was there was a TV movie made. There was a it's been featured in a number of sort of true crime series, documentary series. I mean, it's a story that's, you know, that's gotten a lot of attention for good reason, which is because it's so compelling, and because it's about more than just a crazy nurse. I mean, as horrible as what Jeanine Jones did, what to me made this story really worthy of a book was the bigger picture of the medical officials who had made all this possible, honestly, who had failed to stop her, who had not done the right thing, who had made terrible mistakes that let her go to Kerrville and harm more kids and murder Chelsea McCollin. You know, the tale of a sort of insight into the medical bureaucracy, how it failed to operate properly and protect kids who, you know, whose business it was to protect. That's what made this whole tale all the more chilling.
Now, to keep in line with that, the more shocking aspect of it is not just one person's murderous behavior, but the seemingly uncaring system in practicality because of the bureaucracy itself. Has there been any significant changes as a result of this?
Well, there were some. Not as many as a lot of people felt there should be. I mean, there was very serious consideration given in San Antonio to indicting the hospital district or the medical school or the individuals that ran those institutions for their failure to act, basically as you know, sort of accessories to the crime. That's not a formal charge, but it's what it essentially amounts to. But ultimately, the DA, Sam Millsap, decided not to do that. There was no good to come of that. And it was also partly because by that time, and by the way, this was hotly debated within his staff. There were recommendations by a prosecutor who was kind of the line guy on the case saying we should do this. And the chief investigator of the case said we should do this. Ultimately, he decided not to do it. And part of the reason was that as sort of a wink-wink deal, one of the prosecutors in the office, a senior man, one of Millsap's top deputies, had made clear to the hospital administrator that he needed to cut everybody loose, to fire everybody who had been involved in this and whose hands were unclean. And lo and behold, after that message was delivered not long after. This senior prosecutor was vacationing in Mexico, as I recall, got a message on vacation that all the top officials who had been involved in protecting Jeanine Jones, or who had not responded the way they should, had either resigned or been fired. And the need to do this was communicated with the new hospital administrator, John Gast. And this prosecutor had said to him, he said, "You need to do this." He said, "Sometimes a man's got to do what a man's got to do." And the deputy DA was in Mexico and got a message from his office and said, "I don't know what this means." The message was, "I don't know what this means, but all these people got fired, and you got this message from John Gast saying a man's got to do what a man's got to do."
Yeah. Was there any changes? Because I know it would seem odd to most people, including myself, if this person after 1 year can, usurp someone else's authority and be injecting drugs into people, potentially killing them, whether it's a mistake or it's intentional. But without this training and without doctor's orders, has there been any changes in terms of whose responsibility or who is more responsible for the administration of these drugs?
I think they've, I don't know what's happening today. This is many years later. I do think there was tighter supervision imposed. I think there was, Lord knows if this isn't a consciousness-raising experience, I don't know what is for everyone in the community, everyone within earshot, but especially people in the hospital. And I think they were much more responsive to any hint of a problem going forward. But I don't know explicitly what they did to restrict access to medications. I mean, the reality is doctors and nurses are dealing with very powerful drugs. They're dealing with very sick kids. They are in a position to make a difference between life and death. And, the vast majority of the time, they're helping kids. They're trying to save kids desperately. That's what they've dedicated their lives to doing. The case of a nurse who's harming kids is just so mind-boggling because it's exactly the opposite of what they're there to do and what they've dedicated nurses and doctors dedicate their lives to do. Most of them are doing everything they can to preserve life, not end it. The kids, those kids are so vulnerable. And they're incredibly vulnerable to someone who's, who's got access to drugs, who's responsible for their medical care, and is trying to do the opposite of what they're supposed to do.
Now, what does
it's just something you can't regulate away. You have to, supervise people like this, stop them immediately. If there's any concern about that happening, investigate it. You can't set up a structure. You can't restrict use of drugs. Completely. You have to track it and see if something's being used improperly. But it's hard to set procedures to keep it from happening.
Now, what did Jeanine? What was her response after being sentenced? Finally, what was her position? What was her? What would she claim? What did she have to say?
I interviewed her several times. I interviewed her when she was under suspicion, but had not yet been indicted. I interviewed her in prison after she'd been convicted. And her position on this was the same all the way through it. She was absolutely defiant. She was absolutely insistent. She hadn't done anything wrong. She was fighting for the kids. She was an advocate for the children. She was their best friend. She loved the babies. It was the doctors who had made mistakes. And she went down, just offered a litany of errors. This doctor did this to this kid. This doctor did that. This doctor was incompetent. That doctor was having an affair with somebody. It's all manner of ad hominem, very specific attacks on everyone else, blaming them for what had happened, and accepting no responsibility at all for anything she had done.
How did she stand up during cross-examination?
She didn't. She didn't because she never took the stand, actually. Her lawyers were trying to were weighing whether to have her testify, and she apparently wanted to testify, and she could have insisted on it, but ultimately they persuaded her it was a bad idea. And so she never took the stand and didn't face cross-examination, and it would have been brutal because the facts were nightmarish, were horrible. When I interviewed her, she offered her account of events, and we went, and I spent 4 hours with her in a trailer home in San Angelo, Texas. I declined her offers of food and drink while I was there. Didn't care to have anything from her. But I went through in great detail. Actually, I think I was there for 6 hours. But I went through in great detail, case by case, what happened. And she offered her story about various things. And time and again, she said with absolute conviction, in great detail, in account of what had taken place, which was contradicted by facts and testimony, but facts that were documented in ambulance reports and medical records, sort of absolutely knowable, objective information that proved she was lying about things. But she said it with, if you didn't know better, if you hadn't done the research, what she said seemed very persuasive. She seemed so certain of herself and so caring about the kids. But if you had done research, as I had, talked to people, you not only had their testimony about what happened, which was completely at odds with hers, but you had reports and specific details from documents that made clear she was lying about things. And that would have been withering in cross-examination, would have destroyed her. So ultimately, I think the result would have been the same if she had taken the stand.
Now, she talks about the doctors, of course, not doing their job, misdiagnosis. Is that what she chalked this all up to? Was a conspiracy? How could she explain an innocent person being convicted like herself? Was it a grand conspiracy?
I mean, ultimately, yes. She didn't put it in quite those terms, but that's ultimately what her argument amounted to. The doctors were providing incompetent medical care, and they were covering up their mistakes and blaming it on her. That's ultimately what it amounted to.
Now, we talked about in the introduction that, lo and behold, it can be up for parole in the near future. So tell us what kind of sentence she got and what her parole status is right about now.
Sure. As I mentioned early on in our conversation, the Centers for Disease Control kind of assessed how many, this epidemic that was Janine Jones, Nurse 32, they called her, because they were making a statistical study. And they ultimately concluded there were about as many as 15 or so excess deaths, as they put it, quote-unquote excess deaths, in the intensive care unit in San Antonio. They were never able to convict her of murder in San Antonio. They convicted her. She was convicted in their first trial of murder of Chelsea McClellan and received a sentence of 99 years for murder. And then in San Antonio, she was charged in the case of Rolando Santos, the baby who had those heparin episodes, repeated heparin episodes, but had recovered ultimately when the doctor moved him safely away from Janine Jones. And that injury to a child conviction got her another sentence of 60 years. So she gets 159 years total, but the two sentences were to run concurrently. And in addition, there were Texas mandatory parole statutes in place that had to do with prison overcrowding. And the bottom line in all of this is that even though she's been denied parole, I think, more than a dozen times, she's now facing mandatory parole, to receive mandatory parole in 2018, in early 2018. And, she's been convicted of one murder. She's suspected, believed responsible for multiple murders, and thus been an outcry that she would be one of the first, if not the first, serial killer released on parole. And in any case, whether she is or isn't, that she should remain behind bars for the rest of her life. So there has been an active campaign, really a crusade, from led by parents and also by the victim rights coordinator in the city of Houston, to try to bring pressure to bear to possibly bring another murder case against her and get another conviction that would keep her behind bars forever. That's going to be extremely difficult to do. I think ultimately probably impossible. But they don't want to see her released for understandable reasons. But they're, nonetheless, they're trying to do it. They've started a petition drive. They started a website. And they're putting pressure on prosecutors to try to see if they can bring another charge against her in San Antonio for murder.
Yeah, that's very interesting development because I think that, you know, the level of outrage, like you say, there's people already organizing, but the level of outrage, especially when the media, this is not a kind of crime that, even though it's become more commonplace, is not more easily understood. This is still very,
yeah.
very shocking, and that's what
it
this
is.
Book is, too. I got to applaud you for its very profound experience when you read about Janine Jones saying, oh, I'll take care of the child, or you just leave the room. You won't want to see this. And meanwhile,
mm-hmm.
she's, you know, very ghoulish. I mean, it's very, I don't know, a parent's worst nightmare, you know, is an understatement, but it's very, you've really captured that essence of the horror of Janine Jones, this lovable, trusted woman that couldn't be trusted at all with your with their little kids' lives. And we're talking kids 4 months, and maybe some of them sickly, some of them,
mm-hmm.
you know, but for the most part, again, the kids that should have lived. And so very, very incredibly tragic stories. So I want to applaud you for being able to capture that in this book, The Death Shift. It's been very fascinating. Now, for those people that might want to read about some of your other work, or do you do Facebook? Do you have a website? How might people contact you?
Sure. I appreciate that. I have a website. It's peterelkind.net. It's a personal website. But my job these days is I work for Fortune magazine as a writer where I do investigative reporting and have been on staff for about 17 years. And I write about things like the Enron scandal and the BP oil spill and the Sony Pictures hack. I do business stories these days instead of true crime.
Isn't that true crime?
It is. You're right. You're right, exactly. It's a different form of true crime. The stakes are different. They're not life and death, but there are grave stakes, and they do affect a lot of people. No question about it.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you, Peter, for coming on and talking about The Death Shift, an incredible book and very deservedly a true crime classic now. Absolutely, and great book. And thank you for coming on and talking about it. I really appreciate it.
Very good. Thanks for having me.
You have a great night.
You too.
Good night.
Good night.